the designated hour, having arrived, I call to order this special meeting of Answered Links Quorum Forum Podcast, the podcast local governments need to do business in the chair. It's me, Daniel J. Boland, and on our agenda today, it's our holiday special.
Woo!
All right. The fire's roaring, the bells are jingling. Today we're talking city sidewalks, busy sidewalks with Ansel Glink Defense E-News. And then we're getting in the holiday spirit with holiday spirits and liquor control regulations. But first, let's take the roll. First, we have a litigator at Ansel Glink. She focuses on representing local governments and civil rights, employment, and personal injury matters. She writes for Ansel Glink Defense E-Muse. Christy Michelson is here.
Present.
Christy, every time you're on the show, we talk about E-Muse. How do E-Muse celebrate holidays?
You know, fun fact is that they can go weeks without eating and drinking, so I would imagine that they would be indulging in all of their favorite spirits and food.
Christy, while you discuss these things for the holidays that we're all looking forward to, I'm going to start mixing some drinks.
I think that's a great idea. Let's do it.
I'm sure the E-Muse would enjoy it.
I think that they would.
The name of your publication, do I have it right?
You absolutely do, except it is not E-Muse, it is the E-Muse, as in E-Newsletter.
Nevertheless, we always appreciate your insights about litigation and tall birds. next, we have a partner at Ansel Glink. He effectively and efficiently navigates the zoning and entitlement process for the firm's public and private sector clients. We also have another partner, Ansel Glink. He's a former elected library trustee, and he represents numerous Illinois public library and library districts, both in corporate and litigation settings. They are holiday cocktail experts, and we're going to ask him about it. David Silver and Brett Eiser are here.
Both of us are present.
Hold on, Dan. I'll say here after I'm done shaking this martini. David Silverman is here.
Dan, by the way, I noticed you're wearing a festive outfit for the podcast.
Yeah, it's red suit. You might be familiar with it. It's unfortunate, actually. I picked it up. Santa Claus was at my house on my roof, and actually unfortunately fell off. And so I picked up this suit I found on the ground. And you're all lawyers, so you're probably all familiar with the Santa Claus. It's kind of an end user license agreement. Once you put it on, you've agreed to undertake all the duties and responsibilities of Santa Claus. So unfortunately, at the end of this podcast, I'm going to have to go and fulfill all the responsibilities of Santa.
I'm sorry to hear that, but I see you also bought yourself a beard and some glasses to go with the festive costume.
Yeah, it's a magic suit. As we've talked on this podcast for some reason many times, I can't naturally grow a beard on my own. But this magical suit has somewhat empowered me with a long white beard.
It's a good look for you.
Thank you.
Maybe David's drink tonight will help you grow some whiskers.
Maybe. David, we'll look forward to that later.
We'll need like a stiff cocktail to get things moving, right?
Oh, very good. David and Britt are present. Finally, behind the glass for our protection is Engineer Rick. He is present. We have a quorum. First up is Ansel Glink Defense E-Muse, and Christy, like most folks, this cold weather has me thinking about how freeze-thaw cycles can damage concrete sidewalks. What should local governments be doing to help maintain their sidewalks?
Local governments should have written plans in place to inspect, record, and maintain the conditions of their sidewalks. There was an important decision that recently came out of the Illinois Supreme Court's about trips and falls on sidewalks, which is Monson versus the City of Danville. The background is, in 2012, Barbara Monson was shopping in the City of Danville when she tripped and fell on a sidewalk and sustained multiple injuries. Monson then sued the city for negligence and willful and wanton conduct, alleging that the city failed to maintain their sidewalk in a reasonably safe condition. The city claimed that they had discretionary immunity under the Tort Immunity Act, specifically Section 2-202, which immunizes a public entity from liability for discretionary acts or omissions of its employees. Specifically, the city argued that the public works director made the discretionary final decision about which sections of the sidewalk would be repaired, removed, or replaced. The Illinois Supreme Court said, sorry, city, that's not good enough. You do not have a written policy in place for your sidewalk inspections, nor is there any record of any decision as to why this particular sidewalk slab was not going to be replaced, repaired, or removed. Immunity under Section 2-201 of the Act is available where the public entity has an established policy granting discretion to its personnel to make decisions on a case-by-case basis regarding the best course of action for reducing or eliminating the general risks with trip and fall conditions, and where the public body employee examined the specific conditions and made a discretionary judgment call based on those specific conditions. In its opinion, the court looked at several cases with good inspection procedures, and in those cases, there was a defined written policy, a set of guidelines for any repair or replacement decisions, and a systematic method of inspecting the property in question so that a repair or replacement decision can be identified with specificity after the fact as to any particular part of the property in question. Here, the city of Danville did not present sufficient evidence that it made a conscious decision not to perform the repair on the area where Mrs. Monson fell, which is the subject of this claim. Here, there was no reason given by the city as to why it was not repaired, replaced, or removed.
This sounds like an important case for local government.
It really is.
What should they be doing in response to this case?
Well, this case highlights the importance of having an inspection policy in place, which sets forth the factors on which the decisions to repair are based, outlining the inspection process and granting discretion to its personnel to make the decisions on a case-by-case basis, and also documenting the repair work that was completed or not completed and why, in order to help establish a municipality's immunity and also help maintain their property.
Christy, what if someone stumbles out of a bar drunk and trips on a crack in the sidewalk that is part of a plan, a capital improvement plan for the community?
Is this a law school exam?
I know. Where are my multiple choice options? Obviously, it doesn't matter if you were going to stumble out of a bar drunk. That is, you're going to take your own responsibility for being intoxicated and stumbling onto a sidewalk.
Yes. All right. Yeah, just my one track mind, given where we're going to go with this whole thing.
Naturally, I would expect.
Well, it sounds like the policy that the Supreme Court is talking about here is they want to promote the maintenance of local government property.
Absolutely.
And so, from what it sounds like, it's not only like something you have to do to get discretionary immunity. It might actually be a good idea in terms of from a policy view to help maintain your property.
Absolutely. Not only just for the municipality's, safety, but also for the general public safety.
No, that's good. And this is something that a lot of municipalities already do in many communities, right?
Yes, they do, and they should.
What are some of the features of these inspection plans and improvement plans that you've seen?
They will specify as to where in the municipality they will inspect, or their goals of, trying to inspect one-fifth of their village or city within a year. They will specify what measurements constitute whether or not a sidewalk needs to be ground down or replaced or repaired. And hopefully the budget will allow for those repairs and replacements to be made.
Oh, very, very good. If people have more questions about these kinds of inspection policies, can they email you at podcast@anselflint.com?
Absolutely.
Any final thoughts before we move on with our agenda?
Well, review your inspection policy and compare it to the Supreme Court's ruling in Monson, and if you do not have a policy in place, again, you should review the Supreme Court's ruling in the Monson case.
Oh, Very good. Thanks, Christy. Can you stick around for the rest of the show?
I would love to. I hear there's some holiday spirits.
Oh, that's true. We'll be back after a short recess on Hansiblink's Quorum Forum podcast. And we're back here talking about liquor control, moving on with our agenda. David, Britt, in recent years, the General Assembly has left a couple of presents under the tree for local governments, specifically in the form of new laws about liquor control. Will these new regulations spread more holiday cheer?
Well, Santa, Dan, for decades, the Illinois Liquor Control Act contained restrictions against locating new liquor licensed establishments in close proximity to a church or a school. It was 100 feet. Despite these restrictions, Section 611 of the Local Liquor Control Act also contained dozens of exceptions to this rule, which were enacted by the General Assembly and approved by a city governor. So when you go into the local liquor control statute, you'll see all sorts of exceptions for all sorts of special circumstances all over the state, and it really makes the statute very difficult to work through oftentimes. So the hope is that what these changes that have recently been enacted will clean up a lot of that and make it easier for local governments to deal with proximity issues to churches and schools. I'll explain in a moment what they need to do to exercise these new powers. It should be noted that under Illinois law, local governments have a tremendous amount of control about liquor licensing within their jurisdictions. The state really relies on the local government to decide the types of liquor license categories they want to have, how many establishments they want to have. It's really just up to the individual communities.
So when you're talking about liquor control, like, you need a state liquor license, generally.
Yep. But you cannot get a state license until you first get a local liquor license. Again, the state liquor control agency, will not issue its license until the local jurisdiction, local authority, has issued the license.
And we're talking about today, generally, retail sales, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we are.
So it sounded really inconvenient to have to go get an act of the General Assembly anytime you wanted to get an exception from this prohibition next to schools and churches and what have you.
Right. It is interesting because when you look at a lot of the exceptions, there are a lot of times for, like, university situations, special exemptions for convention centers. It was not necessarily small retailers, but they were certainly affected by this, and it created siting issues in communities, particularly communities with a lot of churches and schools. So that also wanted to derive new revenue sources from liquor sales and things of that nature.
And I guess this is kind of just that long list of exceptions kind of is informative of a trend where there's more relaxed, more permissive liquor control regulations, more modern liquor control regulations coming on the books.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Illinois is actually a bit behind a lot of other states, Colorado, California, Michigan, New York, on opening up its liquor laws. The state has, as anyone who has lived in Illinois and is familiar with Chicago during Prohibition knows that it had a very rich and often violent history with liquor. And as a result, Illinois did have a fairly restrictive three-tier statute, is what it's known as, or a three-tier system. It's more commonly known as, where you separate out the retailers from the producers from the wholesalers. Everyone has to be licensed separately. No one can own an interest in any other. There's a lot of historical reasons for that. But states, in order to promote craft brewing, craft distilling, winemaking operations, have relaxed a lot of their laws to do away with a lot of these restrictions to promote entrepreneurial activity in the craft distilling and brewing space. Again, Illinois is a bit behind on this, but it is relaxing its laws to start taking advantage of what's going on. There's a lot of money out there to support new brewing operations, new distilling operations. It's an important economic development activity for a lot of communities. And right now, pretty much every community that has an opportunity to grab a brewery or a distillery, perhaps even a local winery, would like to do so because it's an attractor for people to come into their downtown areas and generate new sales tax revenue, employment growth, and things like that. So the relaxation of laws is pretty important there.
Yeah, not even downtown areas. No, these are like in their industrial uses.
Absolutely.
And they're bringing tourists and
sure.
people coming out to areas that were never previously activated this way.
For sure. You know, so much of it is dependent on scale. I mean, so, you know, you have the microbreweries, of course. You even have, like, now nanobreweries.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, but what you're talking about is, as we evolve in how we use land, certainly distilleries, breweries, things like that become important land uses, taking over space that may have formerly been used for other retail purposes and or warehousing and industrial uses.
Excellent. So when it comes to opening retail liquor establishments near schools and churches and some of these other sensitive places, what has the General Assembly done to relax that restriction?
So again, they've removed the 100-foot barrier between a licensed establishment, retail establishment, and schools and churches. But you have to do some things as the municipality affirmatively to enable the local liquor control commissioner, who's typically the mayor, to exercise this, to enable the issuance of licenses in distances of less than 100 feet from such uses, schools and churches. And if you think about it, the original rationale for it was, you know, we don't want liquor sales close to schools and churches. There's a sensitivity issue, of course, with the church side of things. And then we don't want kids being exposed or having easy, ready access to grab liquor. But realistically, 100 feet is not a great amount of distance anyways. And it was probably a rather silly enactment, particularly when you also look at the Liquor Control Act and you see all the exceptions that have been granted over a very long period of time. So, in order to exercise this new authority, municipalities that want to approve these exemptions must first pass an ordinance authorizing the local liquor control commissioner to approve the exemption. Local liquor commissioners cannot approve these exemptions until the ordinance is passed. So, if a community wants to exercise greater local control, it must adopt an ordinance that delegates authority to the mayor or village president, again, your local liquor control commissioner, to grant the exceptions to the proximity rules described in Section 611 of the Local Liquor Control Statute and the Liquor Control Act of the state. The law does not describe any limitations on the scope of liquor control, so the exception granted by the local liquor control commissioner may be partial or complete and can be subject to conditions. I think it's important that communities do a couple things in terms of good practices. At a minimum, your liquor licensing application material should mirror the state requirements. You should do those thorough background checks. You want to know who's in your community. You want to understand the relationship between the manager and the owner of the property. Those are very important things because accountability is always a major issue. You want to make sure that, of course, there's dram shop insurance. These are things that are all required by state law anyway, but you should just simply track the statute with your application materials. And if it's too onerous for someone, then that's probably not someone you want operating a liquor establishment in your community, whether it be a bar, retail establishment, or whatnot. Another good practice that we like with our clients, and I think it is pretty common around the state, but if you don't do this, it really is a good practice to have, you should never have available licenses on your books. Because you are creating a right in someone who meets all the requirements to obtain a license if you have available licenses. So it is not uncommon in communities to have the various classifications of liquor licenses and a set number, and they don't always keep up with that number. So you might have three, just hypothetically say, Class B licenses available that no one's using right now. So if someone came in and meets all the requirements to get a license under the statute, they can assert a right to that license, and it creates a problem for the municipality. The better practice is to not put an absolute number in your ordinances on the available licenses out there, and instead do something like what we call an annual fee ordinance, where you would have the licenses listed in an ordinance that's adopted annually to account for all of the licensed establishments in your community. There's a lot of other things that that ordinance can do, but for the purposes of this conversation, we'll keep it focused on liquor licensing. And we can certainly discuss this in greater detail for anyone who has questions about that. But in order to then create a license, since you won't have any extra licenses on the books, the local liquor control commission will do the examination of the applicant, which would include the background check and perhaps even an interview with the applicant. And then an ordinance is introduced at the next city council, village board meeting that can be adopted, creating one license to be issued to that particular applicant in the classification necessary to enable them to do the business that they want to do, assuming they've been approved.
So the difference is that they would have the legislative discretion whether or not to grant the license.
That's right.
Rather than having an available license on the books that just anybody could come in
that's
and
right.
qualifies and get.
That's right.
Oh, that's a good tip.
Yep.
Do you have any other best practices you want to talk about right now, or should we move on to libraries?
Why don't we move on to libraries?
Brett, you're our library guy here today. Dave was talking a lot about the municipalities, and now he's shaking his cocktail shaker some more.
I think he's ready.
I think he's but what do you have to tell us about what the General Assembly has done for libraries in terms of liquor control?
Well, luckily, as you mentioned, Dan, the General Assembly has carved out a few exceptions in the Liquor Control Act for library districts, not for municipal libraries, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Mm. But, you know, you should know, as in my experience with library districts and libraries, that although library directors and their staff may be bookish, they certainly aren't antisocial. And they're willing to have the event, the occasional event that involves alcohol, and we have occasionally, you and I, in fact, I think, have
sure.
answered some questions from our larger library districts that have large meeting rooms or study rooms that they like to close down for certain events. And the Liquor Control Act allows for library districts, under certain circumstances, to serve alcohol during library fundraising events or programs of a cultural or educational nature.
Now, you mentioned library districts and municipal libraries. What are the differences between those?
Well, from a very dry local government perspective, it has to do with their levying powers.
Mm.
Both are sovereign governments, but a municipal library has to put its levy through its municipal host in order to get its money, whereas a library district will fund its functions through its own tax that will appear on the person's property tax, the resident's property tax bill. Library districts also have a little more leeway in how much they tax, whereas municipal libraries are limited by whether they're in a non-home rule community or in a tax-capped community and that sort of thing. But I did want to tell you, for library districts that are thinking of a library fundraiser to bring in friends of the community to perhaps raise money or for a cultural or educational event, the Board of Trustees of that library district must enact an ordinance for the sale of liquor or alcohol, and in that ordinance create a policy that provides that no alcohol be sold or distributed or consumed in any other part of the library accessible to the general public. So you can't sell alcohol to the patrons of the library while you're having the event. It prohibits the removal of alcoholic liquor from the venue during the event and requires that steps be taken to make sure that people under the age of 21 aren't served. Other than that, a library district is open to having these types of events, best practices, if you want to talk about best practices here, the best idea is to just hire a caterer, because you're still going to need a license, and the caterer probably will have
the local liquor license.
Yes.
Britt, this is making me thirsty. I really want to curl up right now with the Illinois Municipal Code and pour myself a drink.
Well, right now we're talking about the Library District Act.
I
think your point is well taken.
Right. Yeah.
Since we're talking about the Liquor Control Act, I think we've all wet kind of our interest in this.
Well, that's fair. That's fair. Any final thoughts, Britt, before we move on with our agenda?
Yes. I meant to say that if you are in a municipal library, because we have plenty of clients who are municipal libraries, you're going to need to go through your host municipality, because unfortunately in the Liquor Control Act, it says nothing. Although it says plenty about library districts, it says nothing about municipal libraries. So municipalities already have the power to adopt an ordinance that allows alcohol sales in a, quote, specifically designated building, end quote, belonging to the municipality. So the library will need to go to the municipality to get this soiree going, and use one of the municipal buildings if the library is not a municipal building.
Very interesting. I'm glad you brought it up, because we prepared these policies for library districts over the years, and we're still getting questions about it. It seems like more and more are trying to take advantage of this new power.
One last thing. Dram Shop Liability Insurance, as David Silverman mentioned, is critical and in fact is required under the statute for these libraries to do these things. It's got to be completely hold harmless the library district. That's all I have.
Oh, that's very good. Britt, thank you for coming. But it is a special meeting. We have to have public comment at every meeting. So let's move on to public comment. Our first question is from Google Buzz user S. Klaus. I work in logistics, and I'll be working late on Christmas Eve. I could really use a refreshing beverage to kick back and relax on Christmas Day. What do you guys think? David, I think this one's for you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it is a happy celebratory time of year. And when I think of happy and celebration, I think champagne. One of my favorite champagne cocktails is a French 75, a classic concoction. Here's what you need and how to make it. You will need a 1/2 ounce of fresh lemon juice that you should squeeze yourself, 1/2 ounce of simple syrup that you can make yourself or buy at the store, 1 ounce of gin, I like Plymouth or Ford's, and 3 ounces of champagne. Add all the ingredients except the champagne into a shaker with ice and shake well. Strain into a champagne flute and top with the champagne. And then you want to garnish it with a lemon twist. I can promise you that will keep you in the holiday spirit when you're with friends, dealing with family, and just dealing with the overall pressures of the season. If you don't like gin, you can make what's known as a French 76, which is the same concoction, except you swap out the gin for vodka.
This sounds like a great beverage. We'll include the recipe in our show notes for anybody that wants to make
absolutely.
It at home.
Absolutely.
While we're working on our next question, it looks like you've poured something for us here, David.
Yeah, what we have here are some martinis, which, again, is another really good, clean, crisp drink for the season. So I think we should pass these out.
Pass these out, and we'll take on our next question.
I noticed they're shaken, not stirred. Oh.
They are shaken, but they are vodka martinis, so that's okay. And vermouth does not mix well with vodka.
Thank you, guys. Our next question is, our park district is very small and only employs 12 people. Do we need to consider the Age Discrimination in Employment Act if we decide to dismiss a 55-year-old employee? What do you guys think?
Yes. The Age Discrimination in Employment Act of 1967 is a U.S. labor law that forbids employment discrimination against anyone at least 40 years of age in the United States. The U.S. Supreme Court weighed in on the application of the ADEA to small state and local government employers in the recent decision, Mount Lemmon Fire District versus Guido. The lawsuit involved a challenge against the fire district when it laid off two employees who claimed that they were terminated because of their age in violation of the ADEA. The fire district argued that the ADEA did not apply because the district employs fewer than 20 people. The appellate court, however, disagreed and said the case was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which upheld the appellate court's ruling in favor of the two employees. In an opinion written by Justice Ginsburg, the U.S. Supreme Court held that the ADA's statutory definition of employer separated private employers with 20 or more employees from state and local government employers with any number of employees. Consequently, the ADEA applies to all state and local governments regardless of the number of employees. This is a significant ruling for small units of government that may have taken the position that they were not subject to the ADEA because they employed less than 20 people.
This sounds like an important case for smaller local governments, especially as our workforce gets older. Sounds like they're going to need to start taking steps to make sure they're in compliance with the ADEA. Thank you, Christy. Next on our agenda is the Department of Public Works. Do you guys have any upcoming speeches, publications, or conferences you'd like to tell us about?
Yeah. First coming up is the CBA Local Government Committee meeting on December 11th. Our very own Carolyn Kraftheffer will be discussing Election Law 101.
Are you speaking at the Parks Conference, Santa Claus?
Maybe. I might still be busy around the world.
He's not going to make an appearance.
That's a good point. Ansel Glenk has about a dozen sessions coming up at the Parks Conference, January 26th to 29th, 2019. The IAPD-IPRA Soaring to New Heights Conference. Soaring as if on a sleigh pulled by eight tiny reindeer. David, what else do you have?
So, Illinois APA Chicago Metro section will be doing the fifth annual bar exam. Mm-hmm. That date is to be determined, but it will be in February, and it will be at Haymarket?
Maybe at Haymarket. Maybe it's at always Haymarket. A good planning law session at with the APA Chicago Metro section at the bar exam.
And then, in addition, the National APA National Planning Conference in San Francisco, April 13th through 16th, both you, Dan Bolin, and I will be speaking there. You'll be discussing regulating short-term rentals, and then I will be discussing intergovernmental dynamics, politics, laws, and schoolhouses, examining the legal relationship and land use issues that arise between competing levels of local government.
And Christy, where can people get Ansel Glenk Defense eMoves if they want to?
You can go on our website, and under the resources, you will be able to find a link. And you can also click on our main page. You can click on the eDefense on the top center of our page.
AnselGlenk.com. Visit it every day if you can. Britton, do you have something?
Yes, as far as upcoming conferences, Dan, it's not too early to mark your calendar for the 2019 Illinois Library Association Conference.
Yes.
That'll be held October 22nd through 24th in 2019 in Tenley Park Convention Center.
Oh.
So I would remind our library listeners of that.
I can't think of a better way to get ready for Halloween than to go to the library.
That's right.
Before we go, we want to remind everyone to subscribe and leave us a review wherever podcasts are heard. We prefer good reviews. Email us your questions and show ideas at podcast@anselglenk.com. And as always, visit us online at quorumforum.anselglenk.com. All right, guys, let's get our beverages out.
Cheers.
Can we get a motion to adjourn?
Happy holidays.
I move to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor, the ayes have it. We'll see you next time. And Ansel Glenk's Quorum Forum Podcast.